We're going to go real fast and turn to the left. In honor of Ford versus Ferrari, what's a sport you don't care about that you would still watch a movie about?
I'm Katie Rich, and with fond memories of Bahubali, the movie we watched for a quarter quill a while ago, I assume there are a lot of Bollywood cricket movies, and maybe I should see one of those, because that game seems weird and like it goes on forever, and it could be interesting.
I'm Matt Patches, and I want a like mumblecore Andrew Bojowski Coob movie. Oh wait, that's a sport. That's a sport I care about. Oh no, I've screwed up.
Yeah.
It's a sport. David sport. Said, no one else cares
with,
about.
I'm gonna go with Mahjong because it's just so percussive and like potentially expressive, as we learned with the Crazy Rich Asians. I guess
that's not a sport. That's a game.
Yeah, I mean Mahjong.
That's another one that Patches cares about.
Say it's not a sport. It's not a game. Fine, running.
But there have been movies about some of these things.
I watched The Running Man.
The question doesn't disqualify sports.
Right,
it's
like I wanted
before.
To go with ping pong, which is my favorite Olympic sport, but there is a movie called Ping Pong, which is very good. There's also Forrest Gump. I also wanted to go with the biathlon, but that's essentially like every James Bond movie where he skis, and also Inception. So I'm going to go with the most boring sport of them all, American football. It's been too long since Rudy.
Wait. And his name is David Ehrlich.
I think there have been other football movies since Rudy. Just
no, but not good ones.
Smirched in memory of draft day.
Oh, right. Well, they don't even play football on draft day.
Someone plays football on draft day, don't they?
They
no,
watch
it's all
football.
About the draft day.
Yeah. Yeah, they haven't gotten to the actual
but,
playing of football.
Everyone's playing football at the draft.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 279, and it's the week of Wednesday, November 13th, 2019. On that day in 1940, Fantasia was released by a studio we definitely will not talk about again in this episode. Before we get started, David, I hear we have reviews.
You hear correctly, Katie.
Rumor has it.
Yeah. Well, I guess we should start with our old friend Malt Raisins, who left an update to his two-star review, or their two-star review, that
wow.
they left. And let me see where it begins.
Does that mean it's still two stars?
Oh, yeah. But
okay,
I did notice that there was... Okay, right, here we go. I can't remember what of this review we've already read, but at a certain point... Oh, edit. Here we go. Edit. Just to clarify... Since you all kept shouting out and insulting me the rest of the episode after reading my review.
You all, excuse me.
He goes on to say, sorry, mostly Katie Rich. The Lighthouse is my favorite film of the year. I mean, if you assume that any of us remember the context in which that matters, you are sorely mistaken, all raisins. I thought they said on the other hand, but it is the acronym for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is second. Important to know. I think tentpole blockbuster movies are often soulless committee tripe for mouth breathers. It'd be great if I could remember what any of this was in reference to, but I can't. I assume most of our readers can't. Listeners, boy. My issue with Ehrlich, it's getting better, is you can do a supercut, piece it together, everything he said about them over the last 5 years, and you might charitably come up with three different critiques sentiments. He even uses identical terminology when trashing them. They all have garbage CGI and garbage action that is all the worst he's seen in the last 10 to 20 years. It's exhausting and predictable. To use his favorite term, enervating. This review is enervating. There's nothing new to say about these films and already histrionically perturbed about having to see and write about them. At least grant him and us a reprieve from having to hear him talk about them. I would love for someone to describe me romantically.
Give you a reprieve of having to talk about superhero movies?
Well, sure, but also to describe me romantically as histrionically perturbed.
Mm.
And then go.
You're married. I think that's required, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not really the same erotic thrill when you ask your partner to call you histrionically perturbed, but maybe someone can write in and let her know. But thanks again, Malt Raisins. Your voice very appreciated. TJ Wells says, What is girl boss may never die. I'm just here to appreciate Patch's Norman Fetus joke that David just ignored. 5 stars. I have to say, TJ Wells, even out of context, that is a wonderful joke. And I must not have heard it because I would have to assume that if I did, I would have laughed a hearty ha-ha. So my apologies
feel free now.
To Matt Patches and to the art of comedy itself. This review is very helpful. Norman Fetus, of course, a reference to Norman Reedus, the star of Death Stranding, a subject of last week's episode or 2 weeks ago, whenever it was. Clegane Bowl for Columbine. He says, gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is a worm groom.
Sure.
Squeaking this in, since David's own BB, hey, that's another Death Stranding reference, is on the way, and I'll be sad when he takes time off from the pod. Oh, that's nice. I suspect it'll be like that drought of episodes where Katie was absent. Sad face. David, I watched that video of you interviewing Destin Daniel Cretton and Brie Larson. Oh, flashback. And when he points out your socks, the cameraman doesn't pan down to show them. What were they? Also, ooh, it's funny seeing you talk in person and to match the disembodied voice I hear in the car. Perhaps it was how you felt when seeing Del Toro or Refn with their new voices in Death Stranding. I only picture you as a hippo.
What video is this? What are you talking about?
Patches, keep up. You're embarrassing yourself. He's talking about how Guillermo del Toro and Nicholas Winding Refn are disembodied versions of themselves.
Yes, I follow that.
Okay, and he's alluding to, famously, a video interview I did at the Google building for Short Term 12.
Extremely famous.
Can you asterisk that famous use of the word famous?
It's on YouTube. It's totally mortifying. I guess the Q&A was fine, but I look and sound like an idiot. And I was apparently wearing mismatched socks that I do every single day because I'm too lazy to knot them together. And I think life could use a little chaos. And I really can't remember what they were. I should take photos of them every single day, mix and match.
Wow, good story.
Anyway, two patches. Patches, if you weren't so busy just running your mouth, we get to the part where I'm sure this listener praises you for reasons unknown. Two patches. Since Tasha Robinson is joining the Polygon fam soonish, is this news? I didn't know that.
It's like last week news.
Any chance you can get her to be a guest?
Wow, way to be in the loop.
Yeah, whatever. Ever since they said that Death Stranding was trying to make Fetch happen, I've blocked Polygon. Any chance you can get her to be a guest on Fighting in the War Room?
There's no way.
and you certainly had to wait.
I have to work with her the next day.
I think it's an HR violation.
Yeah.
It's true. I believe it's in the Constitution. They're having hearings.
Also, she has a good podcast that you should listen to. Oh. The Next Picture Podcast.
Next Picture Podcast.
She has a podcast that you could listen to, is how you could have phrased that sentence.
Nope. I have
a good podcast you could listen to?
I have a good podcast bowling you could
listen
Columbine.
To. Listen to.
Oh, my God. Clegane Bowling for Columbine. Dave has every kind of podcast one person can have.
How long is this review? What is going on?
I am not being glib when I say that would be the most ambitious crossover event in pod history. Again, we're going back to the Tasha Robinson
thing. Right, yes.
To Dave Seven, thank you for the legacy feeds, you beautiful bastard. To Katie, I started listening to Little Goldmen, or as we call it at Shul, Little Goldman. And I like how you wear these two. He didn't say that. I did. It's hilarious. Everyone laughs. And I like how you wear these two podcast hats so effortlessly. You rule.
Hey.
Well, this review was very helpful in completely derailing this episode before it really began. So thank you for that. And finally, we have Razu, who says it's fun, entertaining, and engaging. 5 stars. Love the podcast. I've been a longtime listener and have finally felt the need to write a review. I am writing now with David Ehrlich's voice in my head. It's kind of weird, to be honest, to tell me about it. Anyway, what an amazing podcast. This has been a constant companion for my many long commutes to school. I'm currently in my I can't even speak today. It's Wednesday. We're recording this later in the week than usual, and so we were probably all
your
a little bit more fried.
Has fallen out of your ears.
It has indeed. I'm currently in my senior year of university. Ooh, does that mean that we have a British listener, perhaps?
Yep, yep.
From uni? I can only hope. And I'm working on a couple writing projects, which led me to my question. How did you all feel about your writing assignments? Did you enjoy the prompts, or was it something you begrudgingly did? I want to write professionally, but I'm feeling somewhat discouraged by my not enjoying these assignments. Anyway, great podcast, would recommend. this review helpful for always reminding us that we were young once and in college. Patches, I think this listener is referring to the writing assignments they had in college. And I would just point out the common wisdom about becoming a writer professionally is that it means having homework for every day of your life. And when I talk to my wife about how much I'm looking forward to paternity leave, she rolls her eyes because she's like, you have no idea how exhausting that's going to be. Our friend of the show, friend in life, Allison Wilmore, pointed out to me at a screening of Charlie's Angels the other day that what I'm really looking forward to is not having homework. And that is definitely a reprieve that I think is very real. But I don't know. I've never really enjoyed the homework of it all, but I don't know what to do without it. What do you guys feel?
You'll also miss it. I will tell you. You'll come back.
I'm not going on maternity leave. No, that's a different. I'm only gone for 3 weeks.
Now, I always liked writing prompts because I always felt like I needed something to like tell me what to do with things, which is why, you know, writing movie reviews for the time that I did it was kind of ideal because I was like, all right, here's your thing to write about. But also, sometimes the prompts are something you don't want to write about. I do not think that means that you cannot be a professional writer if you don't like the writing prompts.
But not just the prompts. Yeah, the act of writing is agony.
I would say just execute the ones that you don't like to the best of your ability. And if no one notices you don't like them, then you are a professional writer.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good call.
Yeah, I mean, there has to be a creative way to write around every prompt. I don't know. I didn't have to do writing assignments in college. That sounds horrible. I did. I guess, actually, Dave, you went to NYU, too. We both took writing the essay, right? The mandatory expository writing class. I actually really enjoyed that. You got to write about art. It was awesome. And then the next writing assignments I had were like DVD reviews I did in college for UGO. So my writing prompt was figure out 500 words to write about Nash Bridges season 1. So that's a challenge.
I will say that there are two types of writers. There are people like me, and then there are people who sometimes will write things like on their personal blogs for free, for fun, in their off time. And I think that if you are one of the latter, that probably bodes well for you. I don't know.
As in you are the person who will write the bare minimum of what you have to and then run away as fast as you can?
No, I always just put too much of myself into every assignment, and it is very draining for me, but I also, without those assignments, would not be motivated to write a single word. At least, I don't know, maybe I've just written out. But if you enjoy the process of just writing for your own satisfaction, that probably bodes well. But writing assignments are tough. I don't know. It's a tough game.
Also, my number one tip for being a professional writer is whatever it is that you're writing, no matter how you feel about it, turn it in on time and accept your edits well, and you will go far.
This is definitely true because Katie will complain about people who don't do that off the podcast.
Blowing your deadline is the most obnoxious thing, and it's not easy not to, but like anyone can make a deadline.
Katie really likes it when writers double the word count that she's expecting. Triple it even. The more words you can get in there, the better, right?
Yeah, isn't that a plot point in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, which I haven't seen, where he's like a 300 word thing? That's
he gets a war crime. Oh my God. Serious time from his life to travel to write what is essentially a 400 word blurb, and then he turns in a 10,000 word story, and then in a scene directly out of my fantasies, his editor, rather than firing him, says, "We are going to make this the cover of our magazine."
That's what media was like in the 90s before we got there, right?
Yeah, these are the movies that, you know, not Mr. Rogers, but a lot of the movies about people in media in the 90s that we watched conditioned me to think that this was a good idea when you had a story that you believed in. And then I got an assignment for The Guardian interviewing Jim Jarmusch and turned my story in a month early and four times at the length required of me, and they were not happy. And that was the last time I ever wrote for The Guardian. It turns out one does not balance the other. Learn from my mistakes, Razu. Listen to Katie Rich. She's very wise. You would be amazed at how many people do not meet their deadlines. And so simply the act of doing that will probably work in your favor and get you a long way. Anyway, thank you very much for all these reviews and our unusually long review segment this week. We really appreciate them. We read them on the air, sometimes more coherently than we did tonight. Go on iTunes, Fighting in the War Room. We'd really appreciate it.
So, Katie, tell us about divorce.
Wow, do you know something that I don't? Yeah,
oh, shit. Woof. Whoops.
Tell me about Ennui in the Suburbs, Patches. This is a review of Little Children. we want to talk about Marriage Story, which I believe is out in theaters now and will be on its way to Netflix at some point in the near future at a date that I can never remember because Netflix
December 6th, I believe.
December 6th, you're right. It is in theaters now as of November 6th on Netflix, no, December 6th. You've probably heard about it. It is the movie with Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson as a couple going through a divorce as you meet them there in couples counseling and you watch their relationship kind of further unravel from there as she moves to Los Angeles. He wants to stay in New York. He is a theater director. She is an actress. It is, it's written and directed by Noah Baumbach and is kind of difficult not to think of his, somewhat recent divorce from Jennifer Jason Leigh, although I don't know anything. So don't let that be a plot point. Just know that that's a factor there. And it's a real good movie. It is a kind of movie that it's cliche to say it's the kind of movie that people don't make anymore, but it's at least the kind of movie that only a fancy auteur like Noah Baumbach can get made, where it's about people. It's got great character actors and small parts. It's fairly even-handed in how it deals with these people and their relationship. It's been pointed out by many people that the big
controversial.
Well, hang on. I mean, like compared to something like Kramer versus Kramer, where you meet this couple at the beginning of the movie, Meryl Streep walks out, and it's about Dustin Hoffman kind of learning to be a dad. Like, it is splitting its time between the two much more effortfully than that movie. And it gives room for two pretty standout performances by both of these people. I think Adam Driver is getting a little bit more of the attention, possibly because his role is a little bit bigger, and Adam Driver is kind of, like the poster boy for indie director darling actor right now. Scarlett Johansson, as we'll probably get into, is a little bit more of a tricky figure, but I saw Marriage Story at Toronto. It was not like my favorite movie of the festival, but it was definitely up there, and it's the kind of thing that the more I've thought about it, the more I've been able to appreciate it just for what it does, the fact that it exists, the fact that like there's all these scenes that really stand out in my mind. So I mean, it seems kind of obvious, but like, go see Marriage Story. David.
Well, everyone seems to love this movie except for David.
I mean, it's not that I don't think this movie is a lot of the good things
except
going for it,
but
David. It didn't really resonate with me as I thought it might, as it has for other people. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. Although I do want to speak to the balance between the characters. This is going to be a subject of contention all throughout Oscar season, and so we can probably keep our guns holstered for now. But I will say, from my one viewing of this movie all the way back in August, that I remember feeling like the way that he works out the balance is that the brunt of the time that we spend in the movie is with Adam Driver's character, but the morally, in terms of the who is more responsible for the collapse of this marriage, who has more blood on their hands, essentially, that's also Adam Driver. And so it's you know, not letting him off the hook or siding with him necessarily by spending more time with him. It is just sort of wallowing in his burden and, you know, his responsibility for what's happened. I think his character is much richer and more interesting than Scarlett Johansson's, who gives a pretty run-of-the-mill Scarlett Johansson performance. But richer is probably an operative word there, because one of the things that I found kind of distancing about this movie, and I'm someone who has really gone to bat for a lot of movies about the rich and famous, or at least the rich. I mean, Sofia Coppola, one of my favorite working directors. I think that sometimes when you take financial struggles out of the equation, money can often be an impediment to storytelling as much as it can be a major animating force in storytelling. But I think removing it from the equation, having characters that don't need to think about that, can be liberating in some cases, even if it makes it hard to relate to them in some capacities. I think that when Scarlett Johansson does it, when Sofia Coppola does it, it is not. But in this case, it's really a movie about not just divorce, but being too wealthy to get divorced. And that is really what sandbags them both, is that as the divorce goes on, they both get richer and richer and more successful. And it becomes this really financial war of attrition between the two of them. Just they dig deeper and deeper into their pockets. And I think for, divorce would be just as grueling for any of us plebes, I think that so much of the movie is really about the money of it all, obviously what that money represents and how it becomes ammunition between the two of them. And they go from civil to, we would never haggle over dollars and cents, to being hostile at each other. I don't think the movie does an adequate job of dramatizing that transition from from the civility to the pettiness. And there are a couple of brilliant scenes of Adam Driver, one including a knife, which is as sort of special as anything I've seen this year. But the last 10 minutes.
You make it sound a little more. This movie's not especially violent. So.
No. It's like him alone with a knife and an act like a cooking accident, but it's amazing. The last 10 minutes of this movie, I think, are a disaster. And I found them very fraudulent. And it left me with a bad taste in my mouth. But just, I don't know. I think, you know, Noam Baumbach's movies have a way of growing on me. I had to see Greenberg a number of times before it clicked with me as a misanthrope and became one of my favorite movies of his. And now something I quote all the time, hashtag in the pool overflow. But I think that on first blush, this movie just did not really hit the spots for me. Not in the way that Meyerowitz's Story, the perennially underrated, more recent Baumbach Netflix movie, did. I think that's just a much fuller experience. Can I ask you a
question about this movie? Obviously, it's focused on divorce. It's about a crumbling marriage. But as two married people, what do you think the movie says, successfully or not, about marriage itself? Do you see your own ups and downs in the relationship here? Does it get to something molecular about the marriage relationship?
I think it gets at something about how in a marriage, like, you have kind of a set of expectations of, like, what your situation is or what your expectations are, or, like, what one person's role is and what another one is. And it becomes really easy to let those kinds of sit there. And even if one of you feels it changing, the other one might, because you kind of expect things to be the way that you were, or you're kind of so in your own lived experience, it's a little bit hard to see that person. And I think in divorce, that kind of gets to a really nasty place, because it's so clear in the beginning of the movie that they have this affection for each other. It's not that they hate each other. It's not that there's been like some catastrophic event. It's just this like shift between the two of them that she has noticed more than he has. Not for being an asshole, although I think there's some argument that he's been an asshole a little bit, but that he's living his life and she's living hers, and they're kind of more on diverging paths than they expected. And I feel like it's really thoughtful about that, that it doesn't have to be throwing plates disaster. It can fall apart in a different way from that. Or if you are still married, which David and I both are, that you are aware of those things and you work with them and you continue to keep yourselves on the same track.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I need to see it again. I just, yeah, I mean, the movie does open with what you can see in the trailers, you know, those segments that I think are really effective in a very typically Baumbachian way of, you know, each character indexically listing what they love about one another, and then they pull the rug out from under you. And then when we sort of go back to the action proper, when the movie proper really begins, they are already at the point, you know, beyond the point of no return, their marriage is falling apart. And I think, you know, I was emotionally prepared for a movie that is sort of about the dissolution of a love that feels like it's going to last forever, and that feeling of how something you could be that confident in can sort of slip away from you. And I think if I remember my experience of watching it, it skipped a little bit too far ahead for me, to the point where I didn't feel like I was committed enough to this couple and interested enough in sort of watching them fall away. And I was also like, listen,
not committed enough.
Yeah,
where have I heard that one
nominated for an Oscar for this movie. I do not think that it's an exciting performance. I think it's really just a more concentrated version of what she did in Big Little Lies.
I'm with you on that. I think she's good in the movie, but Big Little Lies is so much more of
it. It completely taints it, because it's like, I've seen this performance before, and that show left a bad taste in my mouth with a disastrous second season, and I was just sort of rolling my eyes at what she does here, even though she gets these like triumphant, you know, fist at the sky monologues. But then you see her in Little Women, where she is fucking amazing, and I just wanted to
all right
this movie
all right
so that
stop
people
showing
focus
us
on that
and privilege
a little bit privilege great movie Shersha for president. Let's move on,
whatever. To wrap up, you know, I know that Adam Driver sings Sondheim in this movie, but you did mention how you think the movie passed the point of no return, so I would like Dave to take us out by singing Phantom of the Opera.
He's there, the phantom.
No, sing the past the point of no return song. Come on.
Oh. Wow, on the spot.
No, I mean, you used to said sing Phantom of the Opera, and I think I did. I think we should.
That's true.
On.
I think he's accepted the prompt.
He's strong, not one to settle down.
Hey, David.
Yeah.
Tell us about Charlie's Angels. It looks kind of sexy and action-packed, but in a way that won't make me feel bad about myself as a man?
Sure. Yeah, I enjoy Charlie's Angels.
You must feel bad about yourself as a man, Dave. I'm sorry.
I mean, I feel bad about myself as a man literally every day of my life. There's nothing Elizabeth Banks can do to fix that or make it worse. But Charlie's Angels is delightful. I think it was a very strange bit of whiplash for me because I went into this movie, you know, not unexcited because I enjoyed the idea of seeing Kristen Stewart sort of go out of her comfort zone. But, you know, my thought being no one in the world is asking for another reboot of Charlie's Angels. And I left it with a very rare feeling in this day and age with a studio movie, which was really wanting a sequel. Because I think the movie sort of tees up. So it is some interesting chemistry and it could go fun places. But what is there to say about Charlie's Angels? I mean, it really starts off in a way that is very worrying. I mean, literally the first line of the movie is Kristen Stewart being like, I think women can do anything. And the opening credit sequence is just this like garbage montage of like found footage of little girls around the world doing the most banal everyday shit. And you're like, Jesus Christ, I feel pandered to. I can only imagine how, you know, a girl who is not 5 years old is going to feel. But I think from that, like what's interesting about it is that the whole idea behind Charlie's Angels is that the world wasn't ready for them, as someone says early on in the film, that they had the element of surprise because men constantly underestimated who they were. But what's interesting about making a movie like Charlie's Angels in 2019 is that while they, you know, misogyny has been cured forever, sexism, a thing of the distant past. No, I kid, but, you know, it's as bad, everything's bad. But on screen, anyway, we are past the point where there's novelty to having a blockbuster that's fronted by women. I mean, Star Wars is about a woman now. Captain Marvel is one of the most successful movies in history. There's Wonder Woman. There's everything else. And so it's not enough for that to be your only gambit or an ace up your sleeve. And the movie doesn't rely on that. Like it sort of gets that out of the way up front and then just becomes a above average action movie with great characters and genuinely funny moments and like a really charismatic attitude. And the way that the way that Elizabeth Banks finds empowerment through the action becomes a lot more organic as it goes along. And the final sort of moment where it's like, you know, women can do anything in the third act is really, I felt, I mean, I saw some other critics calling this out, but I felt very cleverly and satisfyingly done. And that carries over at the end credits into my hopes for a sequel. And so I do feel like by actually making an action movie that looks great, shot by Bill Pope, who shot The Matrix and Baby Driver and all of that, a lot of that great stuff, Matrix sequels also, which look great in spite of their flaws. I mean, the movie looks fantastic. It was all shot on location across Europe. They go from Turkey and Berlin and France and London, all these, and Hamburg, which is in Germany, but all these great places. And Kristen Stewart is fucking hilarious. She's got a vibe that I can't quite put my finger on, but it's like strong, sarcastic, sort of impervious to the seriousness of what's happening, but also panics really easily, kind of in a funny way. A lot of chemistry from the other two women that are on the team with her. The guy who's sort of like the male answer to every female like secretary that's ever been in a spy movie is this guy named Saint, who is like giving them massages and making them probiotic shakes when they come back from their missions, and is also designed like, I thought he was very, very funny. I can't remember what the actor's name is who does that. This is a good time. I don't know, I'm in. Charlie's Angels,
I'll take it.
Yeah,
it sounds like it's maybe a relief to have an action movie that doesn't involve like major IP. Like obviously Charlie's Angels is IP.
How dare you?
This is not really based on anything that pre-exists.
What?
Yeah.
It explicitly relates to things that pre-exist. I don't know what you mean. That's just categorically wrong.
But you don't need to, like, we're about to talk about the fucking Mandalorian, where, like, if you don't know who Yoda is, you don't get it.
Well, I would disagree with that.
But it's telling a story about characters who are within a world that feels new to you. It doesn't require.
Although, isn't this technically in-universe with the previous Angels films? Not
you don't have to have seen the Quibi Charlie's Angels series to understand what's happening in this movie. There are one or two early in the first act references to the previous Charlie's Angels incarnations of all kinds, which are done, again, I found very cleverly. Elizabeth Banks is no dummy, and she, I think she found a very satisfying way to pay homage to McGee's masterpieces. while also moving as far away from them as humanly possible. My biggest criticism about the movie is actually that while it leaps and bounds better than the McGee movies, especially the second one, a lot of nice things to say about the first one for its time anyway. I think that it is a little bit too self-conscious about not being as goofy as those movies. I think for the most part, Banks does a really smart job of threading the needle between Mission Impossible and McGee, but I do wish, because she's such a funny person, and when she lets the movie cut loose with humor, it is genuinely funny. And I do wish that she had, it just feels a little bit restrained. It's like if she had just cut loose a little bit and let things find their natural groove, I think it could have been more successful all around. I hope that if given the opportunity to make a sequel, who knows what this movie's going to do,
can she go full throttle?
That she'll be able to go full throttle. And
yeah,
there's also a character who I swear is like a henchman character who I swear is a nod to Crispin Glover's Thin Man, the creepy Thin Man from Charlie's Angels. I mean, it's like a super tatted up dude who doesn't have any lines. Well, he has one line at the end, whatever, it's dumb. Anyway, Charlie's Angels, not bad.
I did something weird that I don't usually do this Tuesday morning. I woke up.
Dave, are you sure you want to say this on the air? You don't have to admit these things.
you thought I was going somewhere else. I woke up at 4 in the morning. It was still dark outside. Ground the coffee, and as I was, brushing some morning gunk out of my mouth and getting ready for a sweet coffee taste. I browsed on my phone and downloaded the Disney Plus app because Disney Plus went live this week very early. I believe some people had access to it at midnight on Tuesday through like Xbox and PlayStation.
Yeah, it was a slow rollout. It was a slow rollout because they didn't want a billion people going on it at the same exact time. So they never actually announced the launch date. Well, yeah, we'll get there, I guess.
Right. So I got on about 4 a.m. my time, which is about 6 a.m. your guys' time, your guys' East Coast time, and everything was going good. I watched some Mandalorian, obviously, which we're going to talk about, but then immediately started clicking through the Disney Plus features and adding things to my watch list that, honestly, I knew that I was so in the bag for this service that I hadn't really been paying attention to, like, the 3-hour trailer of all the shit they were gonna have, or the tweet threads that had stuff. I paid attention when people would, like, retweet their favorite things.
Three hours is too long for a trailer. I'm take a stand.
Bold.
I agree.
So you were going through the options supermarket sweep style and just adding everything to your queue. National Treasure. National Treasure 2. That's it. All done.
Actually, I was very excited for a lot of the 50s movies. Finally, I could watch Davy Crockett in a way that doesn't suck without, like, buying a Puffy Case video cassette that I don't even know when that would have come out. But I think, like, maybe my cousin had it at some point.
My dad had the Shaggy Dog taped off of something. I don't know. It wasn't an original VHS. It had a handwritten label on it.
Yeah, most of these movies I remember seeing on TV only. I don't know if Davy Crockett had a VHS transfer or not, but I only remember watching these in reruns on Disney Channel.
Oh, well, I mean,
fancy.
Yeah, real bougie.
Yeah, that is fancy.
We only got it when they had the free preview weekends. You remember that?
Yeah, we used to record the free preview weekends.
I'll check my privilege. Non-stop.
Yeah, check your privilege. What are you, marriage?
Anyway, but if you were a Disney Channel kid growing up, they have like a whole bunch of those selections for you too. So I was really interested in terms of initial impressions of the service. On how much I'm like pulling from weird movies that I know my parents or a babysitter showed me at one point in my life, but now is the first time that I would ever have like instant access to it without needing to like pay anything. So I've like, Flight of the Navigator, Return to Oz, computer that wore tennis shoes. Like, my watch list is really weird.
Well, let's pull all the way back, kind of jumping off that, because I want to read the room to know if Disney Plus feels essential, if it feels like a competitor in the streaming wars, which is what everyone is talking about. But, you know, so the backstory here is that in 2012, Disney signed a deal with Netflix, right? And gave all their shit away. And then a few years later, they realized, oh crap, we need to make a streaming platform. And now it is finally here, and they're pulling lots of stuff off Netflix, but some of it won't be off Netflix until like 2021, which Disney Plus will tell you. They have every single movie that they may ever have searchable. You can find the page for like The Lone Ranger, which I tried to dig up tonight.
of course you did.
I know. I can't help it. But if you go to the Lone Ranger page on Disney Plus, it just tells you that it's not going to be available until 2021, which is hilarious.
They give you a date.
They actually give you a very specific. Yeah, exactly. Set a reminder.
I looked up to look for Up because that is one of the movies that I own on Blu-ray that has been in our rotation with our child, and it's not going to be on there for a while, which is annoying because it's like a reason to get up the DVD player.
The collection is still incomplete, but as Dave said, it's expansive. It's over 600 titles of stuff I'm trying to figure out if I would ever watch. You know, right off the bat, I'm flipping through things and I started watching some of the weird movies that were ABC originals or Disney Channel original movies from the 70s. I watched something called Rockstar and the Sultan, which is about a rock star and a tiger walking on the beach. It's 45 minutes long. And then I watched this thing called Fuzz Bucket, which is basically like E.T. It's directed by Mick Garris, Stephen King's go-to guy.
Just, is it not true that you have a job and a child?
My wife wasn't at home. I had free reign over the television. So we're watching the crap on Disney Plus. But that's the thing. Like, even 45 minutes, it's a 45-minute TV movie. This is not something that was ever meant to be put back in front of audiences. It was totally disposable. And so much of Disney Plus is disposable content. I'm trying to imagine, Dave, if you're going to be watching this platform in the years to come. Is this just like we're all going to sign up because we need the Disney movies, the animated classics, the Marvel movies? Do you just need those accessible at all times? Like, does this feel – it's not a Netflix competitor, and at least in my mind. That's not its purpose.
But – one of, like, I mean, they've launched multiple new original TV shows, including The Mandalorian, which we're going to talk about, and many more of them are to come. I don't think it's a Netflix competitor with what's on there right now, but it's got this incredible, like, you have to kind of check it out factor right now that's going to get you to sign up for it and probably forget to cancel after your free trial ends, which is all part of the plan. And then they want to launch a bunch more Mandalorian-sized stuff and, like, new Lizzie McGuire and, like... You know, God, like, they've got the rights to all kinds of, like, ABC stuff that they can put on there. Like, The Simpsons is on there.
I don't think...
It's got, like, the library is more than the Disney nostalgia, even though I think that's a really big pull right now.
I don't think Disney Plus alone is a Netflix competitor. I think Disney Plus and HBO Max and Peacock and all these other little platforms and CBS All Access and that kind of stuff...
Sure.
...becomes a compounded Netflix competitor when you realize, oh, I don't just need to sign up for Netflix to have instant entertainment anymore. I'm now going to a la carte everything, and I'm going to eventually decide, do I really need Netflix based on their original content?
Yeah,
can all of these other streams pull our attention away?
I think if you're just going to sign up for one, Disney Plus is a decent answer at this point.
Right, right.
Now, Katie, when you say things the size of The Mandalorian, I'm curious what you mean, because that piece of shit show is 36 minutes long and I want my money back.
I am so confused by your gripe.
Yeah,
here.
I don't get this part.
I saw you popping off on Twitter.
The Mandalorian right now.
There's so many reasons that
you
I'm baffled.
What this is. This is the oldest Catskills joke in the world. The food is terrible in such small portions.
No, I mean, I hear my complaint about the show is that I feel like I would have enjoyed it more, and I didn't, like, you know, hate it. I think there are things to enjoy for what it is in the pilot episode that we've seen. But I would have enjoyed it more if it were long enough to actually get into it. I mean, I just feel like this.
What
is
do you want to know? Killer. What is it missing?
It's a big killer app for Disney's platform. I'm expecting a show. I mean, it's Star Wars. I am expecting a show on the scale of something like Game of Thrones, where you're going to have to fucking pull teeth to fit all the story you want to tell into an hour.
Why?
And
why?
Because that's like, this is the only reason I'm getting the fucking platform is to watch a Star Wars show. I don't need to sit there and watch Flight of the Navigator. I have a life. Like, I want
to
watch
this. Why does the Star Wars show have to be as dense as, what, Star Wars isn't as dense as Game of Thrones.
Right. Or why does Star Wars have to be prestige? Or why does Star Wars have to be the biggest show that's ever been made? I don't really get that.
I want an hour of television. Why is it not an hour long? There are only going to be 9 episodes of the season or 10 episodes of the season. It's only going to end up to being like 4.5 hours.
First off, every other Star Wars television show in animated form has also been half an hour long or shorter.
It's the big live action fucking show. You're doing world building. You can't tell me that you can't find an additional. Is John, like, if John Favreau can't find another 20 minutes of shit to make me.
But why pad it and why spend tons of money and why make a show that's not as good as The Mandalorian? Is, which I thought it was really satisfying. It, you know, I wrote about it at Polygon.
It was like, it felt like a trailer for the real show.
No, it felt like a disposable half-hour adventure show like you might find. I mean, it's trying to be a Western, right? But it's definitely not like a Western movie. Let me finish.
There's no such thing as a half an hour live action, old school-y drama that you're referring to. I want some meat on the bone. I want some pathos. I want some.
What do you?
Some wrenching.
There's no. You're talking about like Gunsmoke and Bonanza and Rawhide. These shows are not. These shows have depth and are prestige television as we know it today.
You're talking about Gunsmoke and Rawhide. I mean, I read your article, which was very nice. Nice of me to read. I mean, it was crap. No, I'm just kidding. It was very. It was very, very well articulated. I think that Patches drew a really helpful connection between The Mandalorian and someone like Rick Dalton and all the characters that he represents. I wish that I could enjoy the show on that level so far. Maybe it was just a matter of expectations and like that sort of chintzy throwback is not what I'm, despite Star Wars origins and, you know, going back way to the beginning, the kind of things that it was, meaning to pay homage to. I think what was so, spectacular about Star Wars for audiences in 1977 is how it blew them up. It made those things epic. It added scale to those Earthbound.
It's not 1977 anymore.
It isn't?
No. Okay, Scorsese, get over it.
Martin Scorsese is still on top of his
Take your cinema and go.
I don't know.
Would you like to know who I'd like to hear on The Mandalorian?
Yes.
Dave. I'd like to hear from Dave on The Mandalorian.
I guess I should have figured that out by possible.
I know, Dave, I know you've written about it, and I am a worse friend, and I haven't read it. Did you like it?
Yeah, you're not going to tell me that my article is very nice for me to poop on.
Oh, my God. We're going to get Robert Smigel on the show.
Yeah, I really liked it. It is a little bit jarring, but I think it is jarring in an exciting way. And I like the fact that it kind of plays as like a little trailer because it is running week to week. And so in the sense that, David, you're right that we're in the new age of streaming and it doesn't have to be anything it doesn't want to. This seems to be what it wants to be. It looked like all $15 million made it to the screen. And so I can't, it's hard for me to look at the pilot of a series, regardless of whatever series it is, and be like, this is absolute crap or this is absolutely great.
Of course.
But I did think that what it had to do was establish what is Star Wars going to be in scale for a live action television and what is the tone of this particular story we're going to do. And it did both of those things. It's undeniably Star Wars. And it's undeniably trying to be a sci-fi Western. And if you watch The Mandalorian and don't get either of those points, then it would be a failure. But I think both of those come through really clear and it doesn't do anything add so weird that it makes me like dismiss it out of hat. I think it's just surprising enough in its familiarity. And like, I mean, I was trying to communicate this to everybody on GChat and not doing very well because it was early in the morning and I was like just getting caffeinated. But the Gorson score is very Western based, not like Star Wars space opera, John Williams trumpeting romantic.
Yeah.
Which
I really love
that. Is really good, and I came around on it after I'd seen the whole episode because the credits I think really gets towards bridging that gap almost fully to where I could see that as a Star Wars sound. But when it first started with like the flute in the man walks into a snowy bar scene, it was weird to me to see visuals that I associated so much with Star Wars without hearing the sounds of Star Wars. And I'm not necessarily talking about on screen, but I'm talking about like in video games and everything associated with Star Wars, seeing it in like weird concerts, like hearing Asteroid Chase in my head when I'm like playing with spaceship toys. So it successfully reoriented me in a way that felt like not necessarily comfortable, but now that I see, you know, this 30 some minutes vision of it, I'm at least willing to give it the trust of the rest of the season.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the worst thing. That my biggest complaint about the first episode was that I wanted more of it. But that wouldn't have been necessarily a criticism of mine if I didn't feel like it was not enough. And I think a lot of that just has to do with the scale of the project and the expectations that came along with it. And maybe I'd feel differently if I had access to the rest of the episodes, but that being... It's like buying a new video game system, although for very cheap, and there only being like one game demo to play on it rather than fucking like Breath of the Wild or something. So we will see how it goes.
I mean, there are other shows on Disney Plus.
No, there really are. I mean, there really are. I mean, Disney Plus, listen, they're already head and shoulders above Apple TV Plus. So kudos for that.
Are you going to watch a
C? No. But I was also burned by the Lady and the Tramp live action remake, which is dreadful. And
that we can agree upon too.
Yeah, Jesus. And despite Andrew Bujalski's involvement, which is still a head scratcher. I'm just have a sour taste in my mouth about this first week of the new streaming era, where it's the tail wagging the dog. You know, in my reference to Lady and the Tramp, but it's also it's just like they have all this space to fill. And they're just generating content to fill it, and I don't think anyone on our end is winning so far. We're all just spending more money for less satisfaction. Meanwhile, The Crown comes back to Netflix on Friday, and so that's where I'll be.
Crown comes back to Netflix on Sunday, my friend.
Sunday.
What? No,
Netflix
why?
Yeah. Big middle-fingered HBO
for some
reason.
You know what comes on
reason?
Friday? More Mandalorian comes
that
on Friday.
That was my whole weekend.
So you get more of that.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, I got another, another 12 minutes of Mandalorian or whatever.
I will say that it did not just buy a year out. I'm gonna go monthly.
Really?
Oh, I get it free with my cell phone provider for a year.
Oh, you got the Verizon deal.
Thanks, Verizon.
It's the same thing with CBS All Access. Like, they don't put out new content regularly enough for me to pay for them year round. You know, when Picard or Discovery's coming out, I'll catch up on all the other stuff that I missed when I was not doing CBS All Access.
It's very frugal and responsible of you.
Well, I mean, that's what makes it not like a Hulu or not like a Netflix at this point for me, is that, yeah, they have this one show, and to be honest, I'd be willing to pay $7 for, you know, two, or wait, what? I'm willing to pay total what? $14 for all the episodes of The Mandalorian?
Yeah.
That seems fair to me.
Katie, did you watch The Mandalorian?
I watched The Mandalorian.
What did you think about it? Yeah.
No, I liked that. I mean, my sense of like what is and what is not Star Wars is limited entirely to just the movies that come out in theaters, because I'm like a Star Wars novice.
As most people, I think.
Yeah, I think so. So, you know, there's things like it's Horatio Sands who's the alien bounty.
That's
in
right.
The first half of the episode, right? Like, nice. I like that his voice doesn't sound like Star Wars. I liked Pedro Pascal's voice coming out of the helmet that kind of does sound like Star Wars, but sounds very human. You feel like there is somebody in there. I like Taika Waititi, who shows up at the very end as this droid that I thought was funny. Like, it felt Star Warsy to me. The plot is kind of whatever. Like, there's the Werner Herzog scene in the middle is the one that feels like, oh my God, like something's really happening here.
Yeah.
God love them for getting Werner Herzog, who then gave an interview in which he did not see, had never seen another Jon Favreau movie, which makes me so happy.
He's the greatest.
He is the best. And yeah, I mean, it definitely feels like it's setting something up. Like, you get to the very end of the episode, it's got a big reveal of, you know, something that I was pretty intrigued by. I was glad that I watched it. Like, it's free, effectively, Star Wars. It's on my television. I will enjoy watching it. Mm. I'm very curious if, as Dave has suspected, it's going to tie into The Rise of Skywalker, which I feel like it has to. just because of the way that the timing is working out. And it's going to be really interesting to watch if that happens in real time. You hope not.
That's when the show will not be good for me. As I wrote about, like, and as I'm screaming at David about, I think I like how disposable this show is, or I like how it's a problem of the week. As listeners of this show know, I hope, I'm a big Murder, She Wrote fan. Right. And what I like about that show is that you can plug and play and get lots of great actors. Carl Weathers, right? Werner Herzog, Rick Dalton. You can get these people and put them into the show in random roles. And that becomes the fun of it. Or what is the cowboy going to do on this week? Or what mystery is going to be solved this week? That's what I want out of this show and what was so unexpected about it, that it didn't feel, you know, what I don't like about the animated series Clone Wars and Rebels, to get a little in the weeds for what fans may be watching. I didn't really stick with those, or I've watched them sporadically, because they're too lore based. They're Dave Filoni, the guy who creates them, who is also, he directed the pilot to Mandalorian and is heavily involved with Favreau and crafting the show. I don't think he's a character guy, right? He's very much a, let's continue to excavate Star Wars mythology following George Lucas's lead, I guess, of just going batshit nuts and expanding, creating new rules, creating new places, creating new ideas to make the Force more complicated, or make the Jedi more complicated, or make the mythology more intricate. And I'm worried that the cliffhangery final moment of the pilot of Mandalorian is taking us in that direction. And that'll be a bummer, because who gives a shit?
They can't afford to have a Legend of Hercules, Star Wars, or Xena, this kind of show that you see.
Why? You've already signed up for Disney Plus. Of course you could.
Because they.
But isn't that also what the Marvel shows are kind of going to?
Well, those are
going to
be movies that are basically chopped up. Maybe Mandalorian is too.
Are they? Like, not the, like, crazy-ass Vision thing.
Mandalorian did not feel like a chopped-up movie. I see where Patrick's coming from when he's saying it felt more like those old Westerns, or the more modern equivalent of the Zenas and Hercules's. But I think that in this streaming war where everyone is going to be fighting for, there's only so many hours in the day and only so many eyeballs they can have, I don't know if they can afford to have a Star Wars show that is just meandering around the galaxy, which does sound fun. And I think once I was able to adjust my expectations to that, if it was done well, I would greatly enjoy. But it does seem like they might be in for an identity crisis. In the meantime, I can't really cancel Disney Plus with a baby on the way, because I think it's going to be a valuable resource for kid content. Something that I'm really excited to watch, I'm curious if any of you have.
It's Frozen.
The other killer app is not Frozen. Someone pointed out to me on the internet today that I, in my Letterboxd review of Frozen, said that having a child, I would one day have a child just for the satisfaction of not showing them Frozen. And I am now fulfilling that prophecy. Is Forky explains things.
Oh my God, I can't get Charlie to watch it yet. It's breaking my heart.
I haven't watched it, but I am curious, not as curious as I am, of course, about Netflix's promised Paddington for preschoolers show, voiced by Ben Whishaw. But there is other stuff on the Disney Channel. And I think
the Forky series is pretty short, David. So I hope you don't.
Yeah, well, I wasn't expecting a fucking The Irishman from Forky.
Trash.
I'm trash.
Can I tell you guys what we've watched on on Disney Plus so far? I watched The Mandalorian. We have watched several of the Mater-centric Cars shorts.
Whoa.
And we've watched Cars 2, which I've learned has the same plot as Ford v Ferrari, which was an interesting for me. It doesn't really, but it's like he goes over to Italy to race against his like fancy Italian race car, which is basically.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, because I thought in Cars 2, Mater was like James Bond.
Yeah, that's the whole
I'm like, what is Ford versus Ferrari about?
God, remember when they were like, this movie, you know what it needs? More Mater. That should have been our first warning sign.
We've also been watching Cars 3, because that's one that was on Netflix for a long time.
Good chat.
So I'm working on it. Patches, are you going to show your daughter anything on Disney Plus?
Absolutely not.
But just you wait, Forky's gonna find his way to you after all.
The Mickey Mouse Disney shorts are on there. Well, they were on YouTube, so it doesn't mean probably.
Yeah, if I want to scar my child, I'll show her those. They're truly horrific.
Wait, I just basically like came out at the beginning of the segment as like that was a huge plus. I love the fact that things that scarred me as a child are now available on this service.
Return to Oz is just whack.
Yeah, you're going to try to make me watch, trying to make me show my child Return to Oz so you don't have to.
Oh, yes.
Charlie loves electrotherapy.
Return to Oz. Screaming hits. Disney Plus, Mandalorian. I'm sure we're never going to talk about this again.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We will be back next week. Yeah, I guess unless David's baby shows up, which any minute now, right?
When is that happening?
It better not be in the next week. we are a not at all frightening 15 days away from the due date as of now.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And I'm pushing. I decided that my ideal day, if my kid is out there listening, is December 1st. That would be ideal for me. It's like a couple days late, not too late. That'd be great.
I'm sorry you won't get to see Cats 2 before you become a father.
Cats 2?
You can take your kid to see Cats 2 in a couple years. Anyway, in the meantime, tell us who you are.
I'm Matt Patches, senior editor at Polygon. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, Fighting in the Room War. In the Room War. Fightinginthewarroom.com. You can listen to the episodes. Dave, can you listen to the old episodes there, or is that just on iTunes right now?
No. If you go over to fightinginthewarroom.com and go to a little pull-down menu, when you see something that says subscribe/follow us always, click on that, and you can find the legacy links, or you could just search your iTunes.
Yes, I think we've been recommending people go back and listen to old reviews of movies that absolutely no one remembers. That's a good way to end the decade.
I am David Relic. I'm senior film critic for IndieWire. It would be really wonderful for me if you could go on IndieWire and read the story that I just published tonight about Mary Steenburgen's crazy journey from arm surgery to writing the beautiful, should be Oscar nominated song that Jesse Buckley sings the shit out of at the end of Wild Rose.
What is this movie, Wild Rose? I don't even.
Well, that's a great question that you could answer by going on to IndieWire reading the story. It did.
You get
out
a kickback if they win the Oscar.
I do. I stand to make $400,000. It's a small movie that came out in like May or June. Jesse Buckley is just a revelation. And if you haven't seen Beast, which she's also a revelation, she's extraordinary. But she plays an incarcerated, like, delinquent single mother in Glasgow who believes that she was born on the wrong side of the ocean because all she wants to do is be a country singer in Nashville. And she has the most incredible voice, but it has a really difficult time reconciling her dream with the life that she sort of made for herself back home, and the movie is about that. And she sings a song at the end that Mary Steenburgen, yes, Oscar-winning actress Mary Steenburgen, wrote after waking up from a routine arm surgery in 2009, unable to hear anything in her head except for music. The whole world became music in her head, and she was never the same again. It's a crazy story, and I want nothing more than to hear Jesse Buckley belt the shit out of this song, Glasgow, on stage, the Dolby or Kodak, whatever theater it's called these days, on the Oscars.
For like decades.
Great. Film is dead, I guess. At the Oscars. So I wrote a big story about it. Mary Steenburgen was lovely to talk to, as was everyone else. But anyway, that's on IndieWire. Go support it. Support the cause. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich.
I'm not going to read it.
Yeah. Oh, you should read it. I read your fucking Mandalorian thing. I enjoyed it.
I'll read the headline.
For me to poop on.
No, for real, but also to poop on, I suppose. leave us a review on iTunes. And especially when I'm not here on maternity leave, you should leave good reviews, because the show will be greatly improved. Take advantage of it.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me watching Cars 2 on Disney Plus, and I will be sure to inform all of you when we manage to expand our repertoire, but right now it's all Cars 2. You can find me at VanityFair.com and on the Little Gold Men podcast, which, as mentioned by a reviewer, is great. We have an interview with Tracy Letts this week. Everybody likes him. You can also find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich, and we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of Ford vs. Ferrari, what's a sport you don't care about that you would still watch a movie about?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can follow me on Twitter at DA7E. I have a podcast
called
The Storm.
Jesus.
No, I thought it was funny.
I'm done. We're done.